Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 Degree Boiling Hot Water, straight from your kitchen tap. Mine also does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling water too. No more bottle water waste. Go to cooker.co.uk for more details. Today's Lovejoy Hour is 15 questions to Don Letts. Now, Don Letts is a British filmmaker, musician, DJ, broadcaster, and social commentator. Who they say helped introduce reggae to the British punk scene in the 70s. He certainly had a hand in it. He's best known for directing all of the Clash Music's videos and for his films, The Punk Rock Movie and The Clash, Westway to the World, which he won a Grammy for in 2003. Since 2009, he's hosted a slot on BBC Radio 6 Music called Culture Clash every Sunday from 10 to 12. He's recently released a book, There and Black Again, where he looks back on an exceptional life and tells tales of him befriending Bob Marley and becoming one of the UK's most highly regarded video directors during the MTV boom. He directed music videos for Musical Youth, Psychedelic Furs, The Pretenders, Bob Marley, Funboy 3, Elvis Costello. The list goes on and on and on and on. In fact, if I listed the things he'd done, it would take up the whole hour. So let's just talk to him instead. Let's meet him. Here's Don Letts. Hi, Don. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you. Hanging in there.
Good stuff. First thing I've got to say is thank you for doing that Skinhead documentary. I briefly mentioned it when you were on Sunday Brunch, but I loved it. It made a bit of sense of what I was doing in my youth. And so I did. I thoroughly enjoyed that. It was a really good documentary.
No, I thought it was important to clear up the confusion because a lot of people forgot where it started. And where it started was a really beautiful thing because it was a coming together of all these different cultures, you know, unified by music and style, to be honest.
Yeah, well, what I loved about it was because I kind of look back on those days. I always call myself a rude boy. I don't ever call myself a skinner because of the connotations of it. But we were so into the Specials, you know, and the Beat and Selector and Madness and all that thing. You know, the second time it came round, we were all so into it. And it was nice to see how it, on your documentary, how it happened the first time around. Because obviously things are so easy to find out now. But when we were kids, it was tough to understand the roots of how it all began. And it's kind of crazy that it came back 10 years later as well, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that was interesting because obviously the whole punk thing kicked off at the end of the late 70s. And for a lot of working class kids, it was a bit too freaky. You know, it was a bit too out there style-wise, but they wanted to go to the party, so to speak. You know what I mean? So that's where why the second wave of Skinhead really started, because they wanted that energy and they wanted to come together. They wanted a good soundtrack, but they didn't want to necessarily have a mohawk and safety pins. Not that that was what punk was about.
Yeah, well, okay, we'll go on to that, I'm sure, in this thing. But just for anyone who didn't watch it, it was about the Skinhead movement's about the coming together of black and white kids and listening to ska music, and that's why it was so good. It was such a big movement. But then the documentary shows that with the football terraces and everything, it very soon moved the right wing came in and the National Front and all that lot, and they thought, hey, here's a load of white kids with skinheads, let's kind of turn them. And it was that contradiction I remember growing up as a kid, because I used to go to football a lot, and there was all the very right wing elements flogging their wares on the way to the football ground.
Yeah, but we mustn't forget that fascist element was a minority. The majority was a fashion and music element, you know.
Yeah, exactly right. Right, let's go on with some of these questions then. What we'll do, we'll go through and then just see what happens. But what one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Oh, man, I remember as a kid seeing this Western, and there was the young gunslinger asking the old gunslinger for some advice. And the old gunslinger said, draw fast, shoot straight, and don't hit the bystanders. Now, obviously, we've got to put that in a kind of metaphorical context, but that always struck a chord with me, is sort of, you know, knowing what you're after, going for it and not hurting anybody along the way. And that's always stuck with me.
Did you know what you were going for, though? Because your career is so diverse. It just seems that you were just one of those people who was open to everything. You were just observing what was going on and thinking, like, this is good fun to get involved in, and then moving in that direction.
I was just following whatever turned me on, and I was not prepared to be sort of defined by my colour. you know, because I'm black, I'm only going to listen to reggae or soul. If something struck a chord, I was there, man. You know, I was sort of culture clash before that term even came into my vocabulary, because it was all about being honest about what you're into and not following the herd. And I was never prepared to follow anybody.
Right. When you first saw this punk scene, was it when you were working at your shop?
Well, I didn't actually see it because it literally evolved all around me. I was working on the Kings Road Chelsea in the mid-70s, and it was pretty crap times, you know, three-day weeks, strikes. As Johnny Rotten so eloquently put it later on, there was a general feeling of no future for the youth. But at least I had a soundtrack to ease my pain, which was reggae. My white mates, not so lucky. Popular music at the time, totally removed from the vibe on the street. So they set about creating a soundtrack that was of the people, for the people, by the people. Punk rock. And it literally kind of started to grow about 75. And really all came together for me in 1977. And that's when I started DJing at the Roxy, the very first punk rock club in the UK.
Yeah. What was the scene like then? What was it? Was it, I mean, because it was very experimental. No one had ever seen anything like it before. How did it feel to be part of that?
You're talking about the punk rock scene?
Yeah.
Well, you've got to understand, the punk rock that I saw unfold wasn't the tabloid version that the press put across a few years later, because there was no safety pins and mohawks, none of that nonsense. What you had was a load of individual people trying to express themselves and have a bit of freedom. Because the way the press told it, right, it was about negativity and nihilism and all this. And it was never about that, man. It was about empowerment. You know, that's what it was about. And then later on, the mohawks, the safety pins and bin liners came along. And that was really driven by the media. Because, you know, in time-honoured tradition, the media always jumps on these things and puts a version out there that has nothing to do with the reality. It happened to the skinheads, happened to the mods, happened to the rockers. But that's the version that gets disseminated across the country and invariably misinterpreted. But when it started off, I mean, the thing that really struck me about punk rock was the whole DIY thing, do it yourself. You know, my white mates are picking up guitars and I'm like, whoa, I want to pick up something too.
Yeah.
And I picked up a Super 8 camera and sort of reinvented myself as the Don Letts, the filmmaker. Because that's the thing about punk. There was a lot of reinvention going on. You know what I mean, man? It wasn't enough just to be a fan. You wanted to be involved.
Yeah, I spoke to Tony James, actually, who you probably know quite well from Generation X, and I spoke to him about what it was like in the punk scene in those early days, and he said it was sort of mad, great atmosphere. But he said he remembered going to a gig one day and people started spitting and stuff, and he was like, what the hell is happening here? And he said it was all right for him because he stood at the back, but he says Billy Idol was just covered in phlegm, and they never liked that side of it. What happened to it then?
Hey, kids, what are you going to do? I mean, you know, there was a lot of kind of stupidness in the beginning. I mean, there was people walking around with swastikas, for instance, you know, which we kind of had to put our foot down and say, look, that's not something to play with. But initially, it was just kids trying to be extreme, you know, in that way that they do without any thought. And I must admit, yeah, the gobbing thing and the pogo. I mean, that apparently started because Sid Vicious couldn't see a band one day and he started to jump up and down so he could see the band playing, and everyone thought that was a dance. You know, that's how these things happen. But you've got to put a degree of self-interpretation in there, man.
All right, just before we move on to the next question, who was the real deal in the punk movement then? I always imagined John Lydon was, and obviously your mates in The Clash, McLaren, Westwood, were they all the real deal?
Absolutely. I wouldn't be who I am today if I hadn't met McLaren. And was he ruthless? Absolutely. But you know, he was that much older than all of us. So he could put all this kind of counterculture thing in context. You know, it didn't happen in isolation. There was a heritage and a tradition. And Malcolm was the one that made me realize that if I was brave enough and if I had a good idea, you know what, I could be part of this thing too. And that was down to Malcolm, man. So I owe him big time. And, you know, right now the record business could do with a lot more Malcolm McLarens. And Vivian Westwood, you know, what she does with clothes, what she does is art. It's art. There's no other way of putting it. I mean, I got a lot of time for both of them. I was fortunate enough to meet both, before the whole punk thing exploded. And they were my gateway to where I am today. You know, probably one of the most fortuitous meetings I've ever had, and lucky enough to have a friendship with both of them.
Mm. All right, let's get on with some of these questions then. What's the best moment of your career? Christ, that's going to be a really hard one, isn't it? Because you've...
Forget that, man. I'm as old as rock and roll. I mean, how many do you want me to pick? I mean, I've got to always go to seeing The Who when I was 14 years old at the Young Vic. They were the first live band I ever saw. And I was like 14 feet away from the stage. And I remember having an epiphany, man, thinking, you know, wow. You know, I don't know what's happening in front of me, but I want some of this. I, you know, didn't necessarily want to be in a band or be a singer. They just opened the door to a world that seemed really excited and I wanted more. So after seeing that gig, I threw all my school stuff out the door, you know. And then the next big thing would have to be seeing Bob Marley play at the Lyceum a few years later. Obviously walked out of there a changed man. You know, I mean, I walked in this kind of, with this confused idea of being black and British and not really being clear about what that meant. But it certainly felt a lot clearer after seeing him perform, because after that gig, I followed him back to his place and we struck up a kind of friendship. You know, we weren't bosom buddies, but I got to know him for the next few years, particularly when he was staying in the UK in 1977 after being shot in Jamaica.
Mm. Do you still think it's tough to know who you are if you're black and British?
Well, it's a bloody bit easier now than it was back in my day. You know, we say black, British, British, black, kind of rolls off the tongue now, but you've got to understand there was no kind of blueprint for this weird social experiment when I was growing up. I'm a child of Windrush, man. You know, so I'm growing up and I'm looking to Jamaica because that's the land of my parents, but, you know, I'm not Jamaican. I've grown up in the UK. You know, I know where Coronation Street is. Mm. And then we're obviously looking to what's going on in America, because in 68, I'm 12 years old. The whole civil rights thing's going off, the Black Panthers, Angela Davis. But again, not totally translatable to what was happening on the streets of the UK. And it took a long time for it, black and British, to make sense. I mean, I'd say it didn't make any sense till the late 80s when Soul to Soul came along. You know, and in Soul to Soul, the whole Jazzy B thing, you could hear a bit of the nod to the Jamaican stuff and a nod to the American stuff, but it was put through a British filter, you know. And yeah, I'd say black and British meant something when Soul to Soul came along.
Mm. What was it like hanging out with Bob Marley? I mean, when you listen to his quote, I mean, obviously everyone knows his music's fantastic, but when you listen to his quotes, he's a really smart man, isn't he?
He was a smart man, but he was a funny man. There was a lot of humour there too. I mean, obviously, you know, when he's in the spotlight and the media's on him, he can't be like joking her out about, he's got to represent. But, you know, in private moments, he could, you know, share a laugh with anybody, man. Obviously loved football, which is, I mean, he's the only man that's made me regret not being into football. Never been to a football match in my life. Too many geezers. You know, when I was young, I was chasing the girls, not bloody ball. When Bob was staying in Chelsea, he was staying in a place called Oakley Street, just across the road from Battersea Park. And he'd quite often go across and play around a football with his mates and journalists and whoever was visiting him. And I could never take part in that. But I had something else Bob wanted, and that got me through the door.
Which was done?
Well, I was a smart guy and I had a lot of sense. So, you know, Bob used to check me out. He used to check out a lot of people.
All right, we'll leave that there. What's the, I wonder if you've got one of these, what's the worst moment of your career?
Oh, man. Worst moment of my career?
Do you have any bad moments?
Oh, come on, it ain't all roses. But the good stuff just overrides everything else. Because, I mean, it'd be churlish to complain. You know, if you look at my journey, and I'm still standing, mate. You know what I mean? I ain't going nowhere. There's more to come. I'd have to think about the worst time.
Oh, right.
Breaking up with my ex wasn't pleasant. But, you know, that's life stuff. You know what I mean? And the whole fallout with the kids. But you work that shit out. You know, time's a great healer and all that stuff. Can I ask you,
what was it? What was it? You know, you were with The Clash. What was it like when because The Clash became huge worldwide, didn't they? I mean, the punk was a very London thing, well, the British punk, but they managed to cross over to the States. They became absolutely huge, didn't they?
Yeah, no, massive props to The Clash. I mean, first off, we've got to give props to the Sex Pistols, because No Pistols, No Clash. They kick-started everything, but it was only one album. But what an album, you know. But it was the Clash that really gave punk depth and gravitas, you know, with that whole complete body of work. And like you just said, took it global, you know. And I mean, I wouldn't be the filmmaker I am today if it wasn't for the Clash, to be honest, because obviously, I guess you know, I made their first video, London Calling, and then they stuck with me and I did all their videos. And actually ended up getting a Grammy for, what was the document? West Way to the World, you know. So I owe them big time, man. And what I loved about The Clash really is that I could see my culture in their music. They weren't disguised in interpretation. I could hear reggae bass lines in some of their tunes. I could hear Joe Strummer mentioning things like Prince Farai and Dr. Alimentado. And when I was growing up, yeah, that was empowering, you know, to see my culture turning on my white mates and vice versa.
Was it sad though when I was watching a documentary on them the other day, it was really nasty at the end, wasn't it, when the band split up?
Bands, you know, I'm not being funny, but you know, unless you're the Stones and the U2 and a few others, most bands, you know, from the minute you kind of capture people's imaginations, you know, if you look at it, it's amazingly, you know, true this. Most bands, 7-8 years and they split up, all the bands I like anyway. And I just see it as part of the process. You know, I think it's hard to grow as an individual if you're stuck in this family. And I don't see it as a negative thing at all. I just see it as part of the creative process, better than them sticking around and destroying their own legacy, which a lot of people that have overstayed their welcome do.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, if you're lucky in life, you get a window of opportunity. You should use it to the best of your ability, and then you should fuck off and let somebody else have a go.
Yeah, go on, Stones, fuck off. I always think about the Rolling Stones. I was looking at a picture of them today, I think it was a picture from the 90s, might have been late 80s, early 90s, whatever. But those guys have kept their hair, and that's absolutely extraordinary how the whole
band... amazing what a bank account can do. Listen, I'm being horrible because I've been lucky enough to hang out with Keith Richards, and he's the coolest dude. He really is super cool.
Yeah,
I've got a lot of time for the Stones, and you know, you can't keep doing it forever, man, and you can't take away from the great body of work that they started off with. I mean, they've made some incredible albums, and it was never about repetition. Come on, you know.
I've got to say, when I went to see him a few years ago at the O2, and I was thinking, I wonder what this could be like, because they're all quite old. And I was like, wow,
ancient. Let's get it right. They're ancient.
I know, but they know how to perform, those boys.
Yeah, they know how to do their stuff. You know, I mean, mind you, you've had a lot of time to practice, but it's easy to diss them. And indeed, when the Clash started off, they had that song, you know, 1977, where they sang, "No Elvis, Beatles or Rolling Stones." But that's just part of that youth dynamic of feeling like you got to shit on your past to establish who you are. Because truth be told, and you know, with albums like London Calling, they laid their cards on the table and you could see that they were into all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing about the Clash as well is they were also big into the fashion, weren't they? They did a lot of style, like especially with your films and stuff. It wasn't just a band, it was a lot of art involved in it, wasn't there?
I don't think that was just the Clash, although they did it really well. You've got to understand, you know, back in the last half of the 20th century, you know, all those subcultures happened because the only means of empowerment and expression that working class people had was music and the clothes they wore on their back, and they put those two things together and they turned it into a goddamn art form. How else do you have, you know, think about it, you know, you got your Teds, your Mods, your skinheads, your punks, two-tone, rave, soul, but you know what I mean, it goes on and on. And that's because of the power, you know, the importance that British youth put on clothes and music. And that's because it's all we had. You know, now you've got internet and this and that, and it ain't so important. Not to mention it's bloody expensive. You know, it's hard for young people these days to look good. You know, I think maybe it's more important for them to get their heads together than their hairdos.
Yeah, it's funny.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because when you're a kid, you've got to decide on your uniform and you go up to Watford Market like we did and you go, all right, I'll have the waffle cardigan, I'll have the Fred Perry, I'll have the Stay Press, you know, and I'll have the Dr. Martens, you know, Harrington jacket or the flight jacket or whatever. And that's it, you choose your outfit and that's your uniform.
I mean, it seems really simplistic now, but back in the day, you know, these things, we lived and died by these things, man.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, or fortunately, you know, young people, they do have other means of finding their tribes and expressing themselves. It just don't look so good.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. I remember Barry coming to school in a pair of crepe shoes. We were like, what the fuck are you wearing?
Crepe shoes, wicked, wicked.
Yeah, not for us it wasn't. And also the Clash splitting up meant that you ended up creating a band with Mick, so Mick Jones, so Big Audio Dynamite. How did that happen?
Accidentally, I was standing in a club with him one day, and it was me and my other Rasta mate, Leo Williams, who's now in Dread Zone, and he's standing in between us, and he looks to his left, and he looks to his right, and he says, we look like a band. Now, Leo can play bass. I had to remind Mick I can't play anything. And he was quick to remind me that neither could Paul when Paul joined the Clash. They had to put coloured stickers on his fret. Now, difference between Paul Simonon and Don Letts is Paul eventually got rid of his stickers. I never got rid of mine. While I was on stage playing with Big Audio Dynamite, I had these fuck-off coloured stickers to literally show me what to do. But truth be told, my contribution to the band was really lyrics, because I couldn't play anything. I had to justify my space. So I threw myself into lyric writing. And I mean, the first song I ever wrote with Mick was Equals MC Squared, actually. It was our first hit.
Yeah, big song.
And I did all that sample and dialogue stuff, you know, which was a big part of the band's identity. Yeah. You know, stealing stuff from the TV and movies. But I quickly realised you don't get paid for stealing other people's shit.
I met you once, actually. You won't remember, but I was at Glastonbury, and it was because you Big Audio Dynamite were back playing. You were at Glastonbury playing a gig there a few years ago.
2011.
Yeah.
I remember that gig. You want to know why I remember that gig? Because I'm not being funny, but when BAD do it live, always goes down a treat, you know, and I'd say that easily. Glastonbury, which I've always wanted to play with the band. I've DJed there every year for 25 years, but only DJing. Always wanted to play. So we get to play with BAD 2011 during our Reformation. And it's raining, what a surprise. You know, we could deal with that. But the audience all staring at us. They don't look like a BAD crowd. They're all just staring at us like, you know, all right, impress us. And no one seen that move. I mean, that moved. And we couldn't work out what was going on. And we're like, what, is the PA not working or what? Anyway, we leave to, you know, muted applause, it has to be said. And I said to the PA dude, like, you know, what the hell's wrong with this crowd? And they said, oh, they're waiting for the secret band. And I'm like, who's that then? He said, Radiohead. So we've just been played to a bunch of people who've been waiting literally for about 4 hours because they obviously knew. Wow. And all they were just fixated on Tom York and crew. Yeah, so that was a bit surreal.
All right, and next question. I'm interested in your answer to this. What does success mean to you?
Oh, man, I'll tell you when I find out. Now, I wouldn't want to be greedy. I'm lucky enough to have made a living doing something I enjoy. And that's got to be up there in the realms of success, surely.
Yeah, what's weird about your filmmaking is, you know, it's expensive business back then. You know, when I first started making showreels, I used to have to hire a cameraman and a sound guy. Then I used to have to take it and get it edited. It cost me a fortune. I used to have to work for months to get any money to put an insert into a showreel. So how did you go about going, right, I'm going to be a filmmaker? Because that's a commitment, isn't it, financially?
No shit, Sherlock. I mean, when I started shooting on Super 8, filming all the punk stuff in the late 70s, each 3 minutes of film, because that's how it came in little cartridges, cost, with processing, nearly £20.
Right.
Now, if you could do the translation to what that is today, it's probably something like £1,000 for 3 minutes.
Yeah.
That was. Now, 20 quid can buy you nearly 20 gig of information. Is art any better? I'd argue not, because the downside of affordable technology is mediocrity, mate. You know, just because you can afford it don't mean you can do it. You need an idea. And I got to tell you, that £20 per 3 minutes back in the day was the best training I ever had. You know, I never went to film school, never read the instruction book for the goddamn camera. That £20 barrier made me focus.
Yeah, that's why it was funny, because I used to hang out. I had a load of mates who became photographers. We used to hang out around Poland Street and all around there where all the labs were. And it was really weird watching them all disappear. But what happened, I remember having my photograph taken when I was doing my presenting in the end at late 90s. And I remember it the first time a photographer turned up and he had a digital camera. And then the client was looking at the pictures going, get him to do this, get him to do that. And the photographer's looking at me like, holy shit, what am I doing here? And I remember that vividly because it was the day where someone looking at a computer became more important than the photographer. And the film...
Worse than that, they thought they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, and the film didn't mean anything. Whereas before, the Polaroid was so important because they were giving you a snapshot of what was going to be on the reel, and then it was expensive to do.
Well, again, you've just given another classic example. Back in the day, a roll of reel film, 36 exposures, mate. Had to make your mind up. You know what I mean? It is good training, believe me. I mean, all this affordable technology and ease of the access of the internet and all that stuff made things too easy. Mm. You know, that to a degree, the pain and the struggle is part of the creative process.
Mm.
You know, I know that sounds weird, but I sincerely believe that. I mean, I give people examples like, you know, when Joe Strummer decided he wanted to play a guitar, he had to beg, borrow, and steal to get that guitar. And then guess what? He had to do it all again to get an amp. By the time he'd gone through that process, trust me, Joe Strummer wanted to play that guitar.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That's the difference. Now you can download this, download that. I'll have a go at this. Oh, I'll have a go at that. Oh, I'll have a go at this. And it's problematic because all these people having a go clog up space, man. And space is valuable in the 21st century. You know, and you need to justify it. You can't be clogging it up with ego and makeup. You know, because there's people that do have shit to say, you know. I'm waffling now. I hope you cut this down.
No, I don't think you're waffling at all. I think everything you're saying is really smart. And it's made me think that I wonder if the climate out there, the landscape is similar to years ago. There's a lot of troubled people and a lot of people trying to say anything. And as I keep saying on this podcast, art is the way it's going to come through. At the moment, music's just not that exciting, is it? I mean, I don't know where the new David Bowie is or the new Clash.
Well, we've got a problem with music in the 21st century because back in my day, and I said this in my book, music was... It felt like, and we, you know, it was for us an anti-establishment thing, you know what I mean? But now a lot of people get into music to be part of it. Not everybody, but a lot of people get in it because they want to be on TV. They want to be on MTV or music video awards. They want to walk on a red carpet. And if you want all that shit, you ain't going to be that rebellious. You ain't going to be that radical.
Yeah.
You know, the key really is to have new values. The minute you say, you know what, stuff all that, the world becomes a really exciting place. You might have to suffer a little bit more, but I think the creative freedoms are much more rewarding. Mm. You know what I mean? Than being on that same boring ladder. I mean, look what's going on in the 21st century. There's so much rubbish. And that's down to affordable technology. You know, people being able to afford to, you know. So what am I saying? I mean, funny enough, I am an optimist. I mean, I do think there are young people out there that have these new values, don't want what the man's offering and expressing themselves in different ways. It's just that there's so much of everything that nothing means anything. You know, it's just hard to find these people, but they are there. You know,
yeah, my mate's son's in a band, and he refuses to be on social media. He says, if you want to hear me, come and find me. I'm not doing social media. I thought he's about 18. I thought that's quite a different radical way of doing stuff, especially these days where you've got that.
I admire his balls. I mean, you know, I think, you know, Joe Strummer once said something about, you know, you got to make sure your bullshit detector's finely tuned to find the good stuff. And you definitely need that now.
The other thing about music, I remember having this chat with loads of people in the music industry when I was working on XFM and sort of CDs went out and suddenly we're all into MP3 players, iPods and everything. And I said, it's really hard because you're not actually selling anything anymore. You're not actually getting anything for your money apart from a bit of code, which it means it's kind of a bit disposable. And I just said, when I was a kid, I remember getting all my special stuff and my Selectra Madness and all that stuff. And that two-tone stuff meant so much to me that every single single school book I had had two-tone drawn all over it. It represented who I was. I say Watford Market, get the Stay Press and all that sort of stuff. You were actually buying into a whole club, weren't you? And these days, you know, it's music's, you don't own it because you just rent it off Spotify or something. So it's a very different...
We've got to be careful of painting everybody like with the same brush and coming off like old men. By the way, I'm 65 and proud of it, so I don't have a problem with that. But no, I mean, there's this whole disposable side of music that's out there, and it's kind of always been there. You know, it's always been operating parallel to the more radical stuff. And right now, it's reigning supreme. You know, it's like that old adage of the emperor's new clothes.
Yeah,
and his wardrobe's fucking full up. You know, and really, I think in that parable or whatever it is, that story, it's a young person that puts his hand up and says, "Oi, you're naked." You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And I think it's down to the young people to put their hands up and reveal the bullshit. But at the same time, there's all this stuff that's about selling product. There are a lot of young people that are tapped into that lineage and that tradition that I talked about that still see music as a tool for social and personal change. You know, you can't write everybody off because they're trying to sell you shit on the TV. There's still a lot of people that believe in the power of music to affect change. I'm one of them. I'm a product of that stuff. So, and look at all the vinyl thing that's going on. You've seen people want to hold things in their hands again. You know, looking at a playlist on your computer screen. That ain't sexy, man. You know what I mean? Vinyl's selling like crazy now. They started bloody produce cassettes again. So it'll work itself out. I mean, you know, I don't think we should be Luddites about it. All these things have a place. You know, you're trying to carry a box of vinyl on an aeroplane and play a record player on an aeroplane. No. iPod, great for aeroplane. Home, turntable and vinyl. It's not... The thing is, I think we have a tendency, you know, like CDs come in, get rid of your vinyl, let's go CDs. Right, you know, MP3. It's not an either or. All these things have a place. You can actually have it all. Do you know what I mean? It's just... letting each thing find its place. It's kind of obvious, really.
We're pleased to say today's podcast is sponsored by Baroni, fresh frozen pasta now in the freezer aisles in Waitrose. Yes, I did say that, frozen pasta. It's the same pasta that's used in restaurants around the country. What they do is they cook it al dente and then they immediately freeze it. So it has no additives or preservatives in it. All you have to do is drop it in a pan of boiling water and give it a stir. It's ready to serve in only 30 seconds. This stuff is truly delicious. Thank you for sponsoring the podcast. From working through music for years, doing DJing and stuff, and then Soccer AM, and now Sunday Brunch, got to interview a lot of bands and artists. It was all about love for a long time, and now it's all about mental health. All the lyrics about mental health, about how young people are finding it quite hard, society. I think the next bit will be the rebellion bit, and I really do think that. And I think, and I keep saying on this podcast and on my TV show, that art is the thing that will change it all. There's a lyric, isn't there? One lyric, like, you know, John Lydon wrote a load of them. You write a lyric and it can change the way people think. Whereas a loud hailer never does that. You know, a loud hailer just winds people up, annoys people and does all right. Whereas a lyric can just, a bit of art or a stand-up routine or a painting or a Banksy picture, that can change. A bit of graffiti on a wall somewhere can change the way people think, can't it?
Well, the conditions, the social conditions are right for some punk rock.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not talking about mohawks and safety pins. I'm talking about an attitude and a spirit. I mean, look at all the social crisis, cultural crisis, you know, the right wing's on the rise. We got riots on the streets. Sounds like 1977 to me, folks.
Talking about riots on the streets, my next question to you is what's your most outstanding fashion moment? And I wonder if it is the top hat and that famous picture that you
Well, it's a bit of a misnomer, that picture, because what it shows is apparently me fronting a load of cops. What it doesn't show is the brothers behind me with the bricks and bottles about to kick off. And really, I'm just getting out of the way, you know. And obviously, I didn't know that picture was being taken, but there it is.
I love the story of you wearing bondage trousers and Bob Marley not liking it.
I mean, look at a picture of me, 11 years old, with my schoolmates.
Yeah, that's cool. I like the one where you're very rude boy with your white Stay Press.
That's right, you know, that's 5-6 years before two-tone.
Yeah, that's very good shot, that. What did you think when the two-tone label came along and the movement?
Brilliant, because they were the natural children of the whole punky reggae party thing. You know, that kind of the danceability of ska and reggae with the energy of punk. They mashed it together. Boom, two-tone. Wicked. Yeah. And they were singing about something really important. You know, bit musical, had a kind of musical reportage quality about the lyrics. Absolutely brilliant combination. And then to top it off, of course, the whole style thing.
Yeah. Well, Horace Panter says that it's dance music with a serious message. And that's what I love, because you go to specials gigs, still go to them. You know, you can't help but dance because the music's so good. But the lyrics are fantastic, too. It was an interesting time. But sadly, the lyrics still work now, I think. 1967, there's a great picture of you. You're actually wearing a suit. That's one of you with your schoolmates. You got a suit on. How old are you there wearing a suit?
Cool. 11.
That's 11. Cool. I love
Come
that.
On.
So what was it like then when punk turned to new wave and it sort of like it got a bit tacky towards the end, didn't it? Did you all feel that?
Well, it was bloody obvious, because what happened was the Pistols went on the Grundy show. And, you know, caused outrage. And the very next day, that's what punk's about, apparently. Outrage and saying rude words on TV. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, it was never about all that stuff. So almost the next day, all the main players of that initial UK movement dissociated themselves from it. And they didn't call themselves New Wave. That term came from America. All that happened was they kind of started to be more honest about what they really liked. And, you know, you can tell that from things like, I mean, listen to the difference between The Clash's first album and London Calling. You know, going back to that thing about angry kids having to sort of deny their past to establish who they are, by that same token, they do that with this kind of blind energy, which manifests itself as anger and rage. But once you've got past that and you start to be a bit more honest, then for me, the music got more interesting. I mean, look at London Calling. It's reaching out all over the place. It's reflecting what all the different individual band members are into. And look at the reaction to the album. People loved it. I mean, you couldn't keep doing that fast and furious guitar thing forever. That was just a means to an end. Unfortunately, some people stuck with that. Do you know what I mean? You know, punk rock was like this creative ladder, man. And it started with that fast and furious outrage thing. And some people stayed on that rung of the ladder, but others kept climbing. You know, The Clash kept climbing. John Lydon with Public Image kept climbing. The Slits kept climbing, you know, and so on and so forth. And I think the post-punk movement was actually musically a lot more interesting than punk itself. But you couldn't have one without the other.
Was the reggae scene and the punk scene, was everybody hanging out with each other, or was it just you? Because, I mean, obviously I wasn't old enough to hang out around those scenes, but what was happening?
The reggae party was essentially me and my Rasta mates that were running the Roxy. And that was a guy called Leo Williams, T, JR, and my brother Desmond. The club was actually started by a gentleman called Andrew Chakowski, and we've got to give him props for that. And this club was so new in the punk rock scene that there weren't any UK punk records to play. So I played what I was into, hardcore dub reggae. And lucky for me, punks loved it too. And it was really down there that this sort of punky reggae crossover thing started to emerge. And that would manifest itself with, you know, things like The Clash doing Bank Robber, for instance, or White Man in Hammersmith Palais, and Joe singing about Dr. Alimentado and Prince Farai and Leroy Smart and all the rest of it. Or The Slits, for instance. You know, you could hear it in their bass lines. So there was an interesting cultural exchange going on down there, is what I'm saying. And we were turning each other on by understanding our differences, you know, not by trying to be the same. You know what I mean? It was a beautiful thing, man. And it wasn't premeditated. It just happened organically. You know, you look back on it now and go, oh, wow, that was kind of cool, you know.
But when you started hanging out with Bob Marley and stuff, did you try and get him into the punk music?
Well, Bob was staying in London in 1977, just off the King's Road, Chelsea. So he had a front row seat to seeing all this stuff going on. But a lot of his initial information came from the tabloid papers, you know what I mean? So he had a very negative idea of what it was about. And there's a story I've told many times, I guess I'll tell you. You know, one day I went round to his place to collect some money he owed me, and I was wearing bondage trousers. And Bob looks at me and he's like, I'll say it in English. He says, Bob Dunn, you look like one of them nasty punk rockers. You know, what are you dealing with? Mountaineering? And I'm like, Bob, you know, you got it wrong. These people, they're actually my friends. And, you know, there's something going on here. They're, you know, they're like-minded rebels. And Bob basically laughed and told me to get the hell out of there. And I left with my tail between my legs. But 3 months later, a somewhat better informed Bob Marley was moved to write the song Punky Reggae Party. So obviously he got hip to what the whole thing was about and wrote a bloody song about it. You know what I mean?
What was your relationship like with the media, the press? Did they, and the music press, did they like you?
I didn't have a relationship with the press back then. I was a novelty, mate. I was just this black guy with a camera wandering around filming all this stuff. So they didn't take a lot of notice of me. I mean, I did one day read in the NME, Don Letts is making a punk rock movie. And I thought, oh, that's a good idea. I'll call all this stuff I'm filming a movie. And I literally stuck it together. And that was the punk rock movie with that title, because that's what it said in the press. I mean, you've got to understand the mouthy motherfucker. You've got to understand the person I am now. I'm 65 now. Back then I was, I don't know, whatever it was, 18, 19, 20. And I was very much in the shadows, you know, working in the background. I wasn't on stage with the Clash or the Pistols or whatever. So I wasn't the focus of the media by any means. There was plenty of other things going on.
Mm. Can I ask you a question? Because you know so much.
Isn't that what you've been doing?
Yeah, it is. I asked Debbie Harry the same question. And I said, where was punk invented? New York? Or was it invented in London? And she just said to me, we used to look over the pond at each other and then it became a sort of united front. Where do you think it all happened? Because there was a big punk movement going on in New York, wasn't there?
Listen, then you get into the definition. Punk didn't start in either of those places. It probably started in a cave somewhere where the guy hit somebody over the head and said, I don't like that drawing, and he drew something else instead. I mean, you've got to understand what we're talking about is an attitude and a spirit. I know I've said this over and over. And it ain't even just about music and fashion, man. You know, if you look at art throughout the ages, there's examples of people having this attitude and spirit. And as regards to that whole New York and London thing, if you look at the social conditions that inspired both, they were happening at the same time. You know, New York was going through a kind of recession almost the same time as the UK. And the popular music at that time, once again, didn't seem to really connect with what was going on the street. So they happened almost simultaneously. I mean, I think the big difference between the UK scene and the American scene is the Americans were that much older than the UK mob. You know, they were like, you know, in their early to mid 20s and a bit more intellectual, because they'd be reading like Kerouac and Bukowski. Now, the UK lot were in their mid to late teens and they'd be more likely to be reading The Dandy and Beano, do you know what I mean? But you've got to, you know, at that age, you know, the difference between a sort of 17-year-old and a 24-year-old doesn't sound like a big deal now, but it's a big difference at that age. Mm. So they were a bit more intellectual, the Americans, and obviously they weren't as up on the style thing as the British, because British, really, what they did is they took some tips. You know, you got to give props to people like Richard Hell and Patti Smith and Television. You know, you got to give them New York Dolls and Iggy. I mean, come on, you know, and look at the dates of when he's doing his stuff. I mean, he tells you, for Christ's sake, it's 1969. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, you got to give nods. But what the British did in that very colonial way is they kind of colonized it and gave it a style. They gave it the politics for sure. And yeah, they colonized punk. But I'd say that they both had a foot through that door.
Mm. One of the big things you did was start making videos. Videos became so important in the MTV era, didn't it? I mean, I don't know how important they are now as they were, but they were huge. It must have been fantastic to get your hands doing some of those.
It was kind of cool, but hey, listen, I'll tell you what, it was a sort of mixed blessing, because if you were ugly and couldn't dance back then, you were screwed. You know, and I do think it put a bit too much emphasis on style and choreography. And that's why I don't do them anymore. I mean, I got out after about, I don't know, I can't remember. I probably made videos for about, I don't know, maybe 10, maybe 20 years, actually. Damn, I've made about 300, 400 music videos, man.
Jesus.
But I got out of it because all of a sudden, you know, there's a stylist and a choreographer and like 20 people telling you what they think it should be. When I started, it was just me and the band. It was just me and the Clash, you know, and they didn't have aspirations to be film directors yet. And I didn't have aspirations to be in a band yet. Funny how things pan out, isn't it? And also, you know, in my day, I was always trying to say something in my videos, you know, things like, you know, the musical use past the duchy, you know, one of my things I'm most proud of, you know, where I stuck them in front of the Houses of Parliament with their red, gold and green speakers, which was my way of saying, look, this is what England looks like now. You know, it's not guys in beefeater hats and all that nonsense. Mm. And the record company didn't want all that. They just wanted a flog product. So I was eventually sort of phased out. And I didn't want any of that anyway. It was about selling product. And that was not what music is for me. It's about turning people on. It's about passing on the energy that made me who I am.
Mm. Are you enjoying doing the DJing now?
Love the Six Music Show. Six Music Show is very different to what I DJ out and about. When I DJ out and about, it's a bass-heavy set that kind of reflects the legacy. It's a bass-heavy set that reflects the tradition and legacy of Jamaican music. So it's all bass-heavy stuff. But the radio show, man, I'm just... It's not a reggae Don Letts. It's not punk Don Letts. It's just Don Letts. And it's probably the most honest thing I've ever done, in a weird way, because I just play anything that I like. And being the age I am, you know, I've got quite a big cultural suitcase to pull on. But most importantly, you know, a third of every show is brand new music, because I think it's important not to get stuck in your soundtrack, you know what I mean? Because that's when you get really old. Yeah. You got to kind of embrace the new and help things along, man. Yeah, you got to help things along.
Do you love the fact you were there? You witnessed, you've basically been at the forefront of youth culture, haven't you? Pretty much for God knows how many years now. It's kind of interesting that you were there with it all.
That's just because I'm old and I wasn't at the forefront. I mean, I was lucky enough to be part of it. It's helped me to be who I am today. It's sort of the building blocks of Don Letts. And a lot of other people too. It ain't all about Don Letts, you know what I mean? I mean, that whole initiation through the whole subculture thing and expressing ourselves through music and style, it's informed a lot of artists of my age, I guess. You know, it's inherently part of who we are. Mm. Yeah. There's a lot of us out there. There's only one Don Letts.
All right. I was supposed to ask you 15 questions. I've gone through none of them, but I'll just ask another couple of them. What were you like at school?
What was I like at school? Well, when I first went to my secondary school, which was a grammar school, I was the only black kid there for about 2 years. And the right wing were on the rise. In fact, 1968 is when Enoch Powell made the Rivers of Blood speech. And before he made that speech, you know, in the playground, I was like, "Oi, Lexi, you're my mate, Lexi." The next day it was like, "Oi, you black bastard." And it totally, I was going to say, polarized the playground. Polarize the country, mate. But it was character building stuff for me, because at the same time, 68, Trojan Record launches. So I've got a kicking soundtrack that all my white mates kind of like. So they're kind of confused. It's like, well, if he goes home back to his country, maybe he'll take his records with him. I think I'm getting the whole empowerment thing from what was going on in America, because you had the civil rights, you know, with the Black Panthers. You had James Brown singing Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. I think also 1968. So character building times, and went a long way to making me, I was going to say, the mouthy motherfucker I am now. I don't know how else to put it, because I had to stand my ground, mate.
Yeah.
You know, really.
That's why I really loved your Skinhead documentary, because that you've got a couple of guys on there, a white guy and a black guy, talking about, I think they were in, came from Hemel or somewhere, or Tring or somewhere, and they were talking about how they grew up, and then eventually the far right came in, and one of them, and the black guy wasn't able to go anymore or something, and it was like, it was really interesting. You could see the horror in the white guy's face as he realized that's what happened in their youth. I think it was a really important moment in your documentary.
That is the most touching moment in that whole documentary, right there. You hit it on the head. Bit of a spoiler alert, but not really. No, seriously, that's truck. I mean, that, you know, because I know. Well, no, I was going to say I know how that felt, but I was never in that position. I'd already moved on when that right-wing stuff crept in. But you could see it was like a really sad drama coming to a close, you know.
Yeah,
no, very sad.
Yeah. What's the happiest you've ever felt?
Oh, man, I keep banging on about being 65. And as you've said, being a part of all these subcultural moments. But there's been so many. And I'm still standing.
Yeah.
You know, going to Jamaica with John Lydon. Okay, well, let's keep it simple. I've had to pick one up. Going to Jamaica with John Lydon was a major buzz. Because obviously, John Lydon, and it's the first time I'd ever been to Jamaica, and we go with Richard Branson, who's splashing money around the island, signing up artists. So there's like this exodus of every artist that I've ever heard of, except for Bob Marley, Bunny Wailer, and Peter Tosh. Other than those three, I met all of my childhood heroes within the space of about 3 weeks with John. So that was a truly magical moment, without a doubt. There's another hippie one where I was in Yosemite Park, and there was this bloody comet shower that went on for so long, I got fed up. But most mind-blowing thing I've ever seen. And then it's a drag because I'm old and my brain's a bit screwed from whatever. I can't remember it. And I wish to God I could. Because it was one of these meteor showers. It wasn't like whoosh. This thing went on for like about 2 hours. If we could work out the date, we could probably find out what it was. And it was one in a lifetime event. But I remember lying there and then after a while going, all right, I've got to go, that's boring. But,
anyway. No, right.
but hanging out with Keith Richards in Jamaica, that's pretty cool. You know, but, you know, there's a lot, man. Mm. Big Audio Dynamite, you know, going around the world with Mick Jones, people throwing themselves at you, getting the best that the planet had to offer. Great times, you know. Making my first movie in Jamaica, Dancehall Queen, which the people loved. And that was a big reward for this black British kid from Brixton. You know, because in Jamaica now, for the younger generation, Dancehall Queen is the number one cult reggae movie.
Mm.
You know. No, been a few. Been a few, and let's hope there's a few more.
Don, why haven't... I hope they haven't, because if they haven't, I haven't watched it. But why haven't they made a movie about your life yet? Are there two?
Well, somebody did a documentary. The documentary is about 10 years ago called Superstonic, which is the name of my father's sound system that featured me and my son. And then a gentleman called Phil Hunt produced a film called Rebel Dread, which finished just before lockdown. So it was supposed to come out last year and it got pushed back to beginning of this year. And then it's got pushed. It ain't coming out till bloody next year now.
So is that a biopic all about... what happened?
It's a documentary.
Oh, it's a documentary. Yeah, but they should do a proper film about you because it's just...
Yeah, but imagine how expensive that would be. Try imagine, all right, Don, next year, here he is seeing the Who. Here he is in Jamaica with Johnny Rotten. Here he is. Imagine how expensive that film would be.
Yeah. Hey, that's a good point. All right, because you said you saw the comet shower. Well, my favourite question I always ask everyone is, have you seen a ghost or a UFO?
Nah, I'm trying to be clever the dick there, but nah. I mean, I've been buzzed by lots of things that are real. That's enough for me.
All right. Okay, two more questions for you. What's the key to a good relationship? It could be like a romantic or friend or whatever. I mean, you must have had thousands over the years.
What's the question? What's the key to the truth and a good bank account?
That's brilliant. All right. Final question then. What's the meaning of life?
Ah, you got me there. The meaning of life. I know. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, that's it. A good movie.
That's it. That's my answer.
Great. Fantastic. Don, it's been wonderful talking to you. What else you got coming up soon? Anything exciting?
Oh, man, I'm hustling like everybody else. Looking forward to doing some gigs end of June. I've got to go and promote my book because of this COVID thing. They couldn't put the book in the shop. So I've got to go out and do a book tour, which I'm not looking forward to. You did a bloody book and then you think you've spilt your guts and now I've got to go and talk about it. You know, so that's coming up. The radio show's still going on. Still trying to hustle film projects. I mean, basically, like everybody else, I'm hustling, man. I mean, it's a slightly glamorous hustle, but it's a hustle nevertheless.
Nonetheless, yeah, it's a great book. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. So I've still got a bit to go, actually, if I'm truthful with you, but I'm thoroughly enjoying working my way through it. It's really good. It's just because you've done so much in your life. And it's just what I like about you, Don, I'm just to be really flattering here, is you've got an open mind. So many people close their minds to everything. You just seem like wide-eyed and open-minded to everything and go, hey, what's going on over there? Let's go and have a look and see if it's good. You don't seem to be, you know, a lot of people seem to have like blinkers on, don't they?
Well, you just got to be, I mean, Joe Strummer kind of hit me to something. You just got to be open to all the world has to offer. And if it's got a good baseline, even better.
I couldn't agree with that more. Don, thank you so much for joining me today. Been a real pleasure.
Thank you, man. Thanks for the airspace.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.